Welcome to Inside Pop, the weekly podcast that dives inside the world of pop culture. I am Sean David Johnson.
And I'm Amita Patel. We're going to fill you in on the pop culture we care about and you need to know about.
And there is a lot to care about this week. First up, we're going to talk to you about the pop culture we've consumed in the aftermath of American Horror Story, My Washington, D.C. Nightmare, a.k.a. Trump's election.
Deep breaths, people. We'll also share our reactions to the sixth album by legendary hip-hop group A Tribe Called Quest, and we'll discuss their appearance on SNL's post-election episode.
Plus, we're going to review the first four tracks released from the highly anticipated Hamilton mixtape from two perspectives. Mine, the self-proclaimed fourth, Skylar Sister.
Very nice. And mine, just slightly more objective.
Slightly.
Plus, the first in our producer-to-producer series, we sit down with Joel Bach, creator and EP of the Emmy-winning series Years of Living Dangerously on National Geographic.
And, of course, the big sell. All of that ahead on this episode of Inside Pop. Amita, can we kick it?
Yes, we can!
President-elect Donald Trump. That is not a joke. It is not a dream. It is a sad reality that the United States and the world have to face. Like many Americans and people around the world, Amita and I were shocked and angry and in denial in the hours and days following Trump's surprising victory.
We were also faced with the fact that we're living in the same country with millions of people who are happy to vote for Trump. Because of his racist, sexist, xenophobic rhetoric, possibly? That's crazy to me.
But we're a pop culture podcast, not Meet the Press. So we're going to talk about the pop culture we consumed as we processed this new frightening chapter in our history. So Amita, let's start. I just want to ask you, what was the first pop culture you consumed and when after you realized that Donald Trump was going to be our next president?
You put me on the spot because I don't know the first. I was in a haze the last few days are a blur in many ways. I think it was probably Westworld because I was behind on that. And I was like, this is good. This whole sci-fi Western thriller situation is a perfect vacation from life right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Westworld. And maybe an episode of Divorce, but it was joined with a big bowl of mac and cheese and then another big bowl of mac and cheese. Food has been my comfort in this last week.
Eating your political feelings.
Eating them all the time. And then I kind of just went into trying to just do some feel-good stuff, really escapism stuff. So I watched some Lip Sync Battle. I watched The Mindy Project. It's one of my faves. And I got the chance to go to a screening of Moana, the Disney film, last week, which was really, really fun and really nice to kind of sit in a theater with my friend and her two kids, who are the picture of innocence, and see them laugh and smile.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I it's funny because Westworld, on election night, I was, I don't know, around midnight or so, I stopped being in denial, and I realized, okay, Trump's going to win. And I couldn't go to sleep, and I said, okay, I'm just going to take a little break. I'm going to watch Westworld because I'm also behind on that. I just need to escape for half an hour. So I started watching Westworld, and I got about 20 minutes in, and then I said, I can't do this. I need to just finish this out. So I went back to the election. Things were even more grim around 12:30 or so, and then I just went to bed, and I was like, and then I had a dream that Florida had a recount and Hillary won. And that was a dream. I woke up the next day.
But a dream.
One of the things that was interesting for me, about 3 days before the election, I went to see Children of Men, that amazing film. It's one of my favorite films. It's one of my husband's favorite films. And there's a theater in Brooklyn that was showing it on a large screen, I think because of the election. Because, you know, before Election Day, it was still funny to joke about the fact that if Trump's elected, it's the apocalypse. But that film was terrifying in a way that it wasn't when I first saw it, when it first came out, because so many of the things depicted in Children of Men, which is about kind of not post-apocalyptic, but definitely dystopian future in which people have stopped being able to produce children. So it's been 18 years of no births. But then there's also this really strong anti-immigrant current. It takes place in England, mm-hmm. and immigrants mm-hmm. Are grouped together and shipped somewhere. You don't know. Well, and society is basically falling apart. And I thought about Brexit. I thought about what if Trump wins? And yeah, it was terrifying. I mean, that's what good science fiction is. This is a potential future we might experience unless this happens.
Just all the whole thought of it is kind of too much to process still, you know. And I think what was, you know, we were supposed to hang out the day after the election and we kind of just said, you know what, we're not going to do it. I think I just needed to be in a hole in my couch. But we did make sure we went out to get outside and enjoy a little love and music at the Mary J. Blige and Maxwell concert. And that was the perfect thing for me, honestly, to not think about anything, to be in that room with so many great fans. What about you?
Yeah, I think that was 2 days after the election, and it was amazing because, you know, one of the things that Mary J. Blige almost exclusively sings about is relationships and love, and obviously she's going through divorce. And so it was interesting to just focus on – really it was about focusing on her personal life. And it does mm-hmm. remind you that, listen, life will go on. Life goes on. And for me, the most powerful moment of the Maxwell portion of the concert was he did – his always amazing version of Kate Bush's Woman's Work. And mm-hmm. at first it seemed a little incongruous to me, but it worked. And it really hit me powerfully. He, on the screen behind him, had images of Black Lives Matter protests and societal upheaval that we've experienced this past year, accompanying this gorgeous version of this woman's work, which is also, it seems like a very personal song, but then again, personal and political merged together and it made a lot of sense to me and really, really affected me in a way that I don't really want to be affected when I go to a big giant concert at MSG, but it was a powerful experience.
It really was. There was ups and downs and just empowerment and love and acceptance in that room. And I really, really enjoyed having that night. Before going back to reality again.
I know. And the stage I'm in now is, I feel like I've been sad. I've been on my couch. I've been, you know, licking my wounds and feeling fear. And my feeling is I want to continue to feel fear, but also anger. I need I need all this to produce some action. So mm-hmm. Just a couple of days ago, I was like, you know what? What pop culture is going to make me feel... like, what's my favorite angry protest pop culture? And Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn is, I think, one of the greatest social protest songs ever. And so I listened to that song loud and sang along with it. And I listened to a little Donny Hathaway, Tryin' Times. And then just to make myself cry, which it did, when Bill Clinton was elected in 1992, it was the first time I had voted for a presidential candidate who won. And there was an inauguration party sponsored by MTV, and Michael Stipe from REM and Natalie Merchant from 10,000 Maniacs performed and sang to Sir With Love. And it's such a time capsule because I loved both of them. Yeah. It just seems innocent and earnest. And it was a time when we had come from 12 years of Republican presidency, you know, 8 years of Reagan and then 4 years of Bush. Wow. Mm-hmm. We survived that, people. So,
hey.
Yeah. So that just made me feel like, oh, remember how innocent you were, Sean, and how the world just seemed like it was going to get better and better. Mm. And then, of course, I think about Beyonce's At Last when...
You just made me reminded me of that, too. I love that. I love that. I felt like I was at the Obamas renewing of their vows when I saw that, because they look so beautiful dancing too.
Yeah.
But then that song was so amazing too. You know what? I've kind of turned to a little bit of Bob Marley in this time, get up, stand up. And I went to dinner with my cousins last night and Is This Love came on as soon as I walked in, and I just like ran to my cousin. I was like, I want to love you. And it was just like, I do. It's a tough, tough feeling, especially for me. Like, I don't think I've told you this much about it, but like, you know me, and I think you've said it very, very graciously to me on this podcast a few times. I'm extremely positive. I love to spread love and optimism, and I'm extremely optimistic, but that has been tested a lot. It's really hard to talk about because it's been hard.
Mm-hmm. I know. And listen, I think you should maintain your optimism, but, you know, at the same time, you are allowed to feel angry. And because I think, you know, what this election has done to many of us is, for me, it's awakened me to the fact that it's not okay to be complacent. It's not okay to say, oh, I'm sure things will work out, because they may not, right? Things may not work out. So I think it's about vigilance, and I think it's about action, and I think it's about owning your feelings and then doing something about those feelings.
Definitely. And we'll all figure out what's right for us to do and to act upon.
Yes.
And I'm doing that right now. I'm hopefully going to be doing that later today. So.
And I want to give a little shout out to the Joj podcast, because they just released this really amazing episode where it was such a musical education, where they talk about the chronology of protest music. And they talk about folk protest music in the 50s and 60s, soul protest music, hip-hop protest music in the 80s, all the way up until the present. And they kind of count down their favorite protest songs. And it was just this, they're always really smart and insightful and illuminating when they talk about music. And then it was also, for me, really comforting hearing these two citizens of Britain who have gone through Brexit, and guess what? They're still there. They're still living their lives. Yeah. And it makes me think, well, maybe that could be me in a few months, us in a few months. Yeah. So it was, if anyone wants to hear just a very smart perspective on, from someone from another country on our election, and also hear about some great protest music, check out the Joj podcast, J-O-J. And so they're on iTunes and SoundCloud. And so just Google either Screen Dump or J-O-J, Joj Podcast, and you should be able to find them.
We love them. I can't wait to listen to that episode. Another thing that got me through was the new release of A Tribe Called Quest album.
Yes.
That was, I think I texted you as soon as I started to listen to it. It was released on Friday, and I just said, oh my God. And I said, this is exactly what I need in life right now. So, it's called We Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service, which is also, I want to know, I'm sure that might have been a strategic move to also drop that on Veterans Day, which I love even more. And then, you know, after breaking up in 1998, a few sporadic reunions, a documentary detailing their sometimes toxic relationship between Q-Tip and Five Dog, and then, sadly, the death of Five Dog earlier this year in March, a new album seemed not likely, very not likely.
Yeah, I just, that was not one of the pop culture dreams I had. But I guess, you know, before Five passed away, they had been recording basically ever since around this time last year. They performed on Fallon, reuniting to celebrate the anniversary of their first album. So they recorded for about 6 months. And then Q-Tip has spent the past 6 months or so perfecting it. And the results.
Yeah, we got to experience those results on repeat. And Sean, you have said before on this podcast, and I know personally, that you have deemed A Tribe Called Quest your favorite hip-hop group of all time. So, Let's start with you. What did you think of this album?
They are on the very top of my top five.
Wow.
Yeah, I do love them. I have loved them since the early 90s. I was expecting, I was hoping for something great, and they gave me something even greater. So, and I'm going to say before this all-star roster of guests that they have, which is impressive and they're all used so well, I think when I just think about that group and hearing Q-Tip and Fife kind of, you know, exchange bars, go back and forth with each other, it gave me this great feeling of nostalgia about how great they used to be together on record. But it also felt, so it felt like Tribe Called Quest. It felt like their great music from the 90s. But then it didn't just feel like a nostalgia act. It felt really current and of today.
Yeah, that's the first thing that I wrote too. And I was thinking about this. It's like a throwback because it's their sound and it's their feeling. But then the lyrics were so today and so right now and so necessary and so intelligent. And I think my thing is, you know, I love that they pushed past their personal issues. They came back together. They created great music again because they know they can. You know, they've had incredible albums. And what I really love is that there is this generation of people who have no idea who they are. And they now can experience this group with this album, which is incredible. And then maybe they'll go back and they'll experience some of the classic hits and some older albums. And that makes me feel really great about kind of the exposure of A Tribe Called Quest right now.
I agree with you 100%. I love the idea that A Tribe Called Quest is their legacy, which in my mind was cemented, and I think for hip-hop heads, real music fans, cemented. But I agree with you. The fact that this whole new generation will hopefully be exposed to their greatness and explore them. I mean, Low End Theory, their third album, is one of the greatest hip-hop albums of all time. Everyone needs to listen to that album. Listen to all of them. I mean, their last album, the fifth album, The Love Movement, doesn't get a lot of love, but there are some amazing songs on that album too. I think their catalog, their, you know, five albums, perfect, and now this sixth one, it's the exclamation point.
Well said. has there been any particular tracks that you've kind of obsessed over so far?
One of my favorite tracks, the very first time I heard it, "We the People." It's the second track on the album. From the very beginning, I listened to the lyrics and I was like, this is November 2016. You know, it's about gentrification. It's about this right-wing conservative backlash, dismissal of the other. And the melody's so great and Q-Tip's rhymes are so great. It's one of my favorites.
That's a really great track. I really enjoy that one too. I actually, again, first track straight out of the album, The Space Program. I texted you immediately. I was like, this is exactly what I want to hear right now. You know, they are chanting, "We got to get it together." And it's like, yeah, we've got to get it together, you know? Mm-hmm. And I really feel their energy and their strength on that one. I really, really enjoyed that track. Ego also was kind of fun and different for me. I liked Ego a lot. Ego. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I love Solid Wall of Sound, which brings Elton John randomly, but so well.
Oh my gosh. Anytime you sample an Elton John, I'm happy.
And I think that he actually recorded, I'm not sure, I want to look this up. I miss liner notes, people. But I think he recorded vocals for this, so it's not just a sample.
That makes me even happier.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Don't quote me, but I think that might be the case. And I love Conrad Tokyo, which is, no one does kind of weird, quirky hip hop better than A Tribe Called Quest. Although De La Soul gives them a run for their money, I'll say they do that equally well. I love De La Soul also. Kids with Andre 3000 is great.
Yes, so good.
Yeah.
All in all, just a really well-rounded Sonic album. I really, really enjoyed so much of it, and I can't. I keep listening to it over and over again because I find something different that I love about it.
Yeah, every so time many I layers. Listen to it. So many layers. Yeah. Listen for. Have you heard it yet? There's like they actually even sample themselves at least once, and I was just like, "Yep, you should be that cocky. Sample yourself."
I don't think I heard it. I have to listen
It's quick and subtle. I'll let you see if you can find it. One thing I wanted to say is that even though they are my all-time favorite act, the one thing that's always troubled me, and that's the tough thing about, especially back in the 80s and 90s, about being a fan of certain hip-hop musicians, is their homophobia. I mean, there's this one song that the record label actually made them take off of the Low End Theory, the song called Georgie Porgy, which is this like nasty, mean, homophobic song, disgusting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like in that documentary about Tribe Called Quest, Q-Tip called Fife faggoty, like he wanted to insult him. And, you know, I was just like, okay, I've got to love this band, but not love how ignorant they are about gay issues. And that can be challenging. That's another conversation we could have. But was made so happy in We the People when Q-Tip delivers the line. He's kind of speaking in character as someone who, like a villain in the song, where he goes, "All you black people have got to go. All you Mexicans have got to go. Muslims and gays, boy, we hate your ways." And the fact that he grouped Muslims and gays in the same line, to me, what I want to believe is that he's evolved, because I think he's a Muslim. And so the fact that he mentioned Muslims and gay people in the same line as victims of prejudice, I'm wanting to believe is that he's saying, yep, they are both oppressed and they both shouldn't be. So I'm going to give you the credit, Q-Tip. Don't let me down.
Please. Don't let Sean down, Q-Tip.
I love you so much, Q-Tip. Don't be dumb.
He does.
About gay issues.
He really does, Q-Tip, I'll tell you.
Okay, don't. Gay panic. Okay, so Amita, they were, no one else should have been, except for them, the musical guests on,
yes,
I'm going to say, one of the most pressure-filled episodes of Saturday Night Live.
100%
agree. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about this episode a little bit. First of all, what did you think of A Tribe Called Quest's appearance on SNL?
Oh, I loved it. They brought so much energy. I felt kind of joy from them on stage. Like, I felt like they were just like, yes, we're back. We love doing this. We love these tracks. They sang We the People first, and then they sang The Space Program. They just knew that me and Sean wanted to hear those.
Yes, they did.
And, you know, I special requested. And they brought it. And I loved when they brought down this great banner of Fife Dawg, and they just, like, let his verse play. And they were, like, pumping their fists, and they were just, like, in it. And it was great.
Well, let's talk about the rest of the show. What were some of the highlights of the episode for you?
Oh, I love Dave Chappelle. I love the Chappelle Show. I think he was brilliant on that show. And he brought a little of that brilliance back on Saturday Night Live. He made fun of himself. He made sure that he was unapologetic with discussing the election and what's going on. And that first skit of people watching the election results throughout the night, I think it was spot on. And people were kind of being like, oh, Chappelle couldn't act well or he wasn't good. I was like, I don't think it really mattered. I thought him and Chris Rock had a really great kind of chemistry together. And that's what was important. And they were so funny.
That skit, maybe you can help me out, because that was like, to me, that skit had a major flaw to it, which was like, I know what the skit was trying to say. The skit was trying to say, A, let's all look back and see the comedy of our ever-changing mood during election night. And then the second thing I think the skit was trying to say was, oh, white people, everything that you experience on election night, black people have been experiencing it for years. So I get what the skit was trying to do, but the weird thing to me was that Chappelle and Chris Rock almost seemed gleeful that Trump was winning. And it was like this kind of weird Schadenfreude thing of like, ha ha, silly liberal white people. Like, look what's happening to you. And like, I think the thing that it was missing is black people we're doing the exact same thing and feeling as like surprised and confused as angry. So it was weird. I
get that. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So
I
like,
see what you're saying.
And it's like they were just like the way they were just like standing behind the couch, and I don't know. It that one felt a little off to me. I applaud the intent, but it just seemed weird.
I like the intent in 100%. I thought the intent was good. There were, like I said, it felt a little awkward, but it meant to be that. And I think that message was definitely received. I think the other one, if anybody tunes into Saturday Night Live and gets to towards the end half of the show, usually sometimes the stuff falls flat. And once in a while, SNL does something really outrageous. And they did one at the end of this episode with Dave Chappelle. And one of my favorite things is when people break and when the entire couch that was in the skit all couldn't hold it in and were like breaking down laughing. And it was the best. Essentially, Dave Chappelle lives at home with his mama and still breastfeeds. And that's the skit.
And his mama's Leslie Jones, who is
the best.
Leslie
Jones. That's all you need to know. And it's, I just think it was so funny.
It was. It was like so silly and slapsticky, but so funny and yeah. Just like dumb in the best way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, we have to mention when they make their top 10 greatest moments of SNL, Kate McKinnon as yes. Hillary Clinton opening the show, singing Hallelujah, which was written by Leonard Cohen, who had also just passed away that week.
I know.
I mean, I just – have you read – I need to do research. I want to know whose idea this yeah. was, because I think the idea was brilliant, and Kate McKinnon's performance, because she sang it as a very subtle version of her Hillary character. You yeah. know, like she had the wink in there. She had a little bit of the vocal inflection, mm. and her voice was – beautiful. That's such a hard song to sing.
It is.
And
she sounded wonderful.
So moving and tear inducing, I'll say it. And
yeah.
But I think it just summed up everything we were feeling without being overtly political.
Right, but I also think that there was not like the exact wink that she did, but the entire opening segment was a huge wink. You know, somebody had posted this on social media that, you know, SNL has a really great track record of doing poignant, moving segments after something happens. And usually those somethings are tragedies. They had this really amazing 9/11, you know, open, and it was very moving. And they had another one after Hurricane Sandy. They do this often, and it's usually after some tragedy. And I thought it was interesting. And it's not like they're trying to say that, but I felt it.
Well, because it is a tragedy. Donald Trump, a man who has never held office, who has never served in the military, he's the first person to be elected to the presidency. He said mean, spiteful, insulting things. This is a great American tragedy. And I just,
know.
You know what? I just pray that he rises to the occasion and he surprises us, and that he lied a little bit during the election to get the conservative vote, and that he's a little bit more moderate and a little bit more sane than he would have us believe.
Definitely.
That's all the time I'm giving Donald Trump, more than he deserves. Don't go anywhere, though, because coming up is our interview with the co-creator of Years of Living Dangerously and our big sell. But first, we want to discuss four tracks from the upcoming Hamilton mixtape. Genius Lin-Manuel Miranda recruited some of the biggest stars in music to re-record songs from his popular award-winning musical, Hamilton. I've seen the show and listened to the original soundtrack about 1 quadrillion times, so I'm hyped for this mixtape, but also a little wary because I love those original songs so much. Amita, you have not heard the soundtrack yet?
No, sir.
And you have not seen the musical?
Please do not remind me. I need to join the lottery every day. I'm trying. Anybody out there, any fans, if you want to take me as your date, I'm a really fun date.
So we're going to do a little experiment of sorts. Since I come with a lot of baggage to these mixtape songs, and Amita hasn't experienced any of them yet, we're going to do a little experiment, a little review, where Amita has listened to these songs, and she's come to these songs a fresh, new.
Nubile.
And she'll give you her review, and then I will give my completely unobjective reaction to those songs. So the first track we want to discuss from Hamilton, the Hamilton mixtape, is Kelly Clarkson singing It's Quiet Uptown. So Amita, what did you think of that song?
I am a very big fan of Kelly Clarkson. Love, love, love her voice. And I liked this song. Upon listening to it the first time, I was like, all right. But then I listened to it actually two times, and I started to appreciate it a little bit more. It has a very Already Gone feeling, if you guys know that track from her that Ryan Tedder produced, that sounds a lot like Beyonce's Halo. I digress. It sounds a little bit in that realm, and so it's very suited to her voice. I felt the lyrics really well. Like, I think that she kind of conveyed the story really well. I have no idea what she's talking about.
That's what I was going to ask you, because in some ways, I agree. I really love her version. And again, I'm so married to that original song in which both Hamilton and Eliza, his wife, and Angelica, his sister-in-law, all sing the song. It's almost like a three-part song. But I think it works to have Kelly take the song and just make it her own. It does seem more personal, although I don't know if it makes sense as one person singing it.
Well, now that you've told me that, yeah, that might help. I've had a couple other people in there. It's very interesting that they didn't give her up other people. Like, why not? A lot of the other songs are a varied cast of characters, yeah, and singers. Yeah. I'm surprised that they did not put her with somebody else. Like, oh, maybe a little Carrie Underwood, put some American Idols together. That'd be fun.
Oh yeah, that would be fun. That would be really cool to have an American Idol reunion of that type.
You know, the mixtape's not done yet. It's not out yet. Lynn, give us a call. We got you.
Lynn's like, I've been working on this for a year and a half. It's done.
Chill, Anita, chill.
But I also like that song. I think her, you know, sometimes I'm not a huge Kelly Clarkson fan, but that girl can blow. She has a good voice, and she really does convey a very powerful emotion that makes the song work as a pop song. Mm-hmm, so I'm going to give that one a thumbs up.
Oh, goodness. I feel your tone that maybe there's some that are not in your opinion, but it's not your opinion now. It's mine.
Yes. So next up, Amita, I would love to hear what you think about the song Satisfied, which is sung by Sia, Miguel, and Queen Latifah.
First of all,
stellar.
What a combination right there. Clearly, Sia and Miguel, we just saw them in concert. They must have been doing this somehow together while they were on the road, I hope, in my dreams. Queen Latifah is on fire, as always. I love her. Miguel, not enough Miguel. That's my opinion on that. And Sia is great. Again, context, feeling a little lost, but enjoying the beat, enjoying the melody of it. The only thing I thought of was you and how incredibly conflicted you might have been that one of your favorite artists, Miguel, is now singing as one of your favorite Broadway characters and Alexander Hamilton.
Yes.
How do you feel about this track?
Well, I am actually going to give a little preview to our year end countdown. Satisfied is going to be on my list of favorite songs of the year.
Wow.
Satisfied is, for me, when I saw the musical, I listened to the soundtrack once or twice, and just to kind of get acquainted, because it's so layered and so kind of jam-packed with narrative and story. And so I loved Satisfied when I heard it, but then when I saw it performed by the phenomenal, exquisite Renee Elise Goldsberry, I think I stopped breathing for the entire song. Her performance of the song is so flawless, and, you know, kind of what Sia and Queen Latifah share, she does on stage while moving around and dancing. It's so amazing. It's like, again, it's very complicated plotline. And it's Angelica Schuyler, who is in love with Hamilton, but decides to introduce her sister to Hamilton.
You had explained this to me once before in another realm. So I kind of knew a little bit about that before I listened to it. Well, when I was listening to Trek, I was like, oh, this is that triangle that he was telling me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's like great writing by Lin-Manuel to, you know, in a story mainly about men, to kind of take this female character and to try to make sense of this seemingly irrational thing that she does. And for me, it becomes one of the hugest highlights of a musical that's filled with highlights. So I'm going to say that I wasn't ready for anyone else to share the song. Renee Elise Goldsberry does such a phenomenal job. And when I first heard the song, I was like, Sia, I like you a lot, but your inflections and your voice, it wasn't really connecting for me, and I felt bad. I love Queen Latifah's rap on the song, and I'll just say again, Renee both sings and raps. It's so good.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. But I like Miguel's voice because Alexander Hamilton is this player, right? Like, that's how he's presented in the play. Like, he sleeps with a lot of women. Martha Washington named her Tomcat Alexander Hamilton. That's a true story, as stated in the musical.
Okay.
So anyway, I will say and stop babbling. I love the song so much that I listened a second time and opened myself up to it a little bit and appreciated the different take Sia was giving us. So I'm just going to say I'm not ready for this song because all I need is the original in my life.
Got it. Understood. The next one that I listened to was My Shot, which was a great collaboration featuring The Roots, Busta Rhymes, Joell Ortiz, and Nate Roos. I know this song, so I have to be clear here. I know this one. This was kind of the one that was going on every commercial, and I think they performed it at the Tonys or something or whatever. Obviously, most people kind of correlate this song with Hamilton because it's what they promoted the most, I feel. So I knew the song. I like kind of like the more just dirtier, grittier urban feel that they put on this. And all I knew is like, I'm going to go to the gym and work out to this song. That's what I need to do. That's what it gave me, this great empowering, you know, uplifting feel, which I really liked.
Yeah, I love it. I love how it's different, how it's somehow even more energetic than the original song.
Mm.
You know, I love The Roots. I feel like if you have any type of revolution, Busta Rhymes should be part of said revolution because
love him.
He's a madman. Yeah, so it's great. So I really like that. I would say I don't have an emotional connection to that song because it's just like kind of such a big rousing, like, let's do this, let's have a revolution. And
yeah.
And I feel like that's something that's speaking to many of us right now.
Yes.
So
yes,
good for that
was
song.
Helpful. That was very helpful. Save the best for last, in my opinion. What an appropriate song to release in the times that we live in right now. The song Immigrants, We Get the Job Done, that featured Kanan, Snow the Product, Riz MC, and Residente. And this was such a great track. I think out of all of them, this actually might be my favorite. Mm-hmm. I want to listen to it more to really kind of absorb a lot of the lyrics and the raps by these really incredible rappers and performers, but I just obviously in these times and the whole issue with immigration and some idiots gonna build fences and walls, I just loved feeling empowered by a song like this as a child of an immigrant.
Yeah, I agree. It's and I love the fact that it is out of the four we've discussed, it's definitely the least faithful to the original song. They basically sample Immigrants, We Get the Job Done, and then but everything else is new and different, new rhymes and new music. And I think maybe that's the direction hopefully more of these songs will go. Just like, don't try to be faithful to what those original talented stars did, just create something new, like mix it up, mash it up. Yeah. Which is what hip hop does so well.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I agree. Love the sentiment and I love the execution of that song.
Yeah. And I think he was really smart. I don't know what the process was to choose the people to do each song. And, you know, by choosing Kanan and choosing, you know, Snow the Product and Residente and Riz MC, you know, like really, if it was handpicked or not, a really diverse cast of rappers here, you know, performing this Immigrants We Get the Job Done song. And for those who may not know some of these artists, Kanan you might know a little bit. He's had a couple singles here and there, so you can definitely look him up. Snow the Product I had never heard of, Residente I'd never heard of, but Riz MC I had heard of. For those who may not know who Riz MC is, he's also known as the actor Riz Ahmed, starring in The Night Of that everybody has been talking about this summer, and also is going to be in Rogue One. What a multi-talented future Amita husband. Said it.
What I was just about to say, what 2015 was for Oscar Isaac, I feel like 2016 is for Riz Ahmed.
Well said. Agreed. I
do
love
it,
him.
Riz.
I love him.
Sorry for the tangent, but I'm going to ask you, do you, like, in your soul love him, or do you physically love him? Like, do you want to be with him?
Both.
Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure. Interesting. So he is attractive to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow. Thanks for the judgment.
Just asking.
And not to you.
I love his spirit.
I know. I don't know what it is about him. I think he's attractive. I mean, you know me. You all know me. Like, the attraction also comes with like a great deal of talent. Talent is very attractive to me as well. So I think the talent that he put in The Night Of, and then I went into a really interesting rabbit hole once I saw that he was on this track and started to kind of like look into his recent music. And he's put out some recent tracks this summer. And then somehow on YouTube, they gave me this gift of a show, a British radio show a few years ago that he guested on with Childish Gambino, and they both kind of freestyled or just kind of did their own raps.
Ooh, let's put that in our show notes.
It was so great. I was like, what? This is like my world colliding.
Oh, that was made for you. That's some
it was
Amita fantasy action going on right there.
A little bit. A little bit.
Now I'm excited to see that. Yeah, please, we're going to share that in the show notes, and you'll share this with me right after we record.
Yes.
I want to check that out.
And yeah, they did it to like this really great Bollywood beat too, so it's kind of fun.
Oh, I love Bollywood. Okay, so those are the first four tracks that we have right now. The full album is coming out
December 2nd.
Can't wait. I hope that there will be videos of all these people in the studio recording, because it would be great to see them in action doing a lot of this. And
yeah.
You know, my guess is I'll like some, I'll love some, I won't care for some. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. But kudos to Lin-Manuel Miranda and working along with Questlove and the Roots. Putting this together while starring 7 shows a week, while writing Moana, he is nonstop.
He really is. He's incredible.
So kudos to this. And I just can't wait to kind of dive in and explore this latest work of this genius.
Yeah, I can't wait to listen to it too. Up next, we are excited to share our interview with Joel Bach, the co-creator of the Emmy-winning series Years of Living Dangerously. The series takes some of our best-known celebrities and follows them as they explore the effect climate change has around the world.
The show has just begun its second season, so we sat down with Joel to discuss the challenges and rewards of bringing high-profile celebs around the world to spread the word about the dangers of climate change.
Welcome, Joel. We're super, super excited to have you here on the podcast. Joel and I have known each other for the better part of 16 years, 17
years,
something like that. Joel was the very first producer I ever worked with, so he's considered a mentor to me, and I love him very much, and I'm so, so excited to talk about this series with you.
Well, thank you, guys. I'm excited to be here as well. This is great.
So I first just have to say bravo to the series. What I love about the series is that they kind of explore the culture of each region that they're in, but also learn about what is and isn't being done to conserve energy and resources in that area. They serve as hosts and investigators, and they tell the story. And I love that aspect of it.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it. And you're right. It's a pretty big undertaking.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get this many people involved, though, you know, they all want to do it. It's just a matter of finding the right mix of people, and it takes a lot of time to cast the show. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're really happy with the people we found. You know, from you know Jack Black to Gisele Bündchen to Dave Letterman, it's just an incredible honor to work with these guys. Super fun. Great.
For sure. And it's something that they're all really personally passionate about. And maybe most people wouldn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think one of the big surprises for a lot of people is Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's, you know, the former governor of California and big box office star. And in season one, he was one of our cast members. And I know in going on his Facebook page that his fans or a lot of his fans were really surprised that Arnold had any interest in the environment. They're like, what? Like, we didn't know you cared about this stuff. And, you know, this is the guy who was the governor of California. And when he was governor, he passed some of the most sweeping climate legislation that we have. So despite the fact that he did that, still a lot of people out there have no idea that Arnold, this Republican former governor, cares about climate change. So, and it's happening again, you know, he's part of season two as well as an executive producer, but also as a correspondent. And I see the same posts on his Facebook page, like, wow, we had no idea. Or some people get angry that he cares about it. But for the most part, his fans are excited that he cares about climate change.
It is surprising to me that, you know, the issue of climate change has become such a blue state, red state, Republican, Democrat thing, because it's our environment, it's the world. And you know, one of the things that really spoke to me while watching the episode featuring David Letterman on the ideas of solar power, David Letterman and Cecily Strong,
yep,
is the fact that there is business to be made. There is money to be made in researching and utilizing alternate forms of energy. And I think that episode really shined a light on that. But that division is interesting to me.
Well, you know, in that episode, we have two stories, as you just mentioned. There's the David Letterman story where he goes to India to see what that country is doing to combat climate change or deal with this problem. And then the other story that's interwoven with it is Cecily Strong of SNL. And she's here in the United States, and she's trying to understand where we are with solar and renewables. And basically the takeaway is that India has the will to go big on solar, but they don't have the way. They just don't have the resources. They're still a relatively poor country, and they don't have the money. And here in the U.S., we have the way, but not the will, because we keep fighting about climate change and renewables and solar and what, you know, whether we should be investing in these things, especially with, you know, these cases like Solyndra, these big solar companies that supposedly went belly up. But those get the attention when actually solar is doing pretty well in this country, but there's still a big pushback here. So those two stories worked really well together, and it was great to have two comedians tell those stories, especially Dave. I mean, Dave really kind of lets loose, and he's Dave Letterman in India, a place he'd never been before. And, you know, he's just funny. He's funny the whole time, which is a big part of why we wanted him to be on the show, and Cecily too, is that they're just entertaining people. And with a subject like climate change, you need some humor, and you need people to watch, and it's truly entertaining TV. And then along the way, hopefully you learn something about what's going on.
Yeah, it's a perfect combination. And was that part of the, you know, initial seeds of creating this series? I'd love to get back into like how you started this. Is that what you really wanted to execute when you first thought of the series?
Well, my partner David Gelber and I, we're at 60 Minutes, and we felt that, you know, basically at the time, this was maybe 6 years ago, that people's understanding of climate change was synonymous with Al Gore. So it's like, you know, this is just Al Gore's issue. Mm-hmm. And Al Gore's a hero of mine. I think he's really led the charge on this. But a lot of people decided, because Al Gore was pushing so hard on it, that it was a political story, or that he had politicized it. And we wanted to, in a sense, de-Al-Gore-ify climate change and say he's not the only guy who cares about this. There are an awful lot of other people out there who are hugely concerned with climate change and see it as the big story out there. And so we thought, why don't we put together an ensemble cast of big Hollywood stars? We didn't know any big Hollywood stars. That was the one problem. I guess we knew a couple, but we didn't really know how to get to the Matt Damon's of the world and Arnold Schwarzenegger's. So we, through a college friend of mine, we eventually hooked up with Jerry Weintraub. And we called, I mean, I was at 60 Minutes and I had reached out to Jerry Weintraub and through his niece. And she said, you know, I can guarantee you'll get a phone call from him. I can't guarantee what he's going to do, but he will call you back. And so a couple of weeks passed, my phone rang. It's like, hey, it's Jerry Weintraub. What do you want, kid? And I said, well, I guess we're trying to do a show on climate change and we really want to get some big name people involved like Matt Damon and George Clooney and so forth. And he said, you want Clooney? You want Damon? You got to come out and talk to me. Okay. We're not going to do this on the phone. And so, you know, David and I flew out and we had this 24-hour meeting with Jerry Weintraub, who passed away last year, but in his home in Palm Springs. And by the end, I guess it was like a 24-hour interview. He wanted to see if he liked us, but somehow I guess we passed the test. And then a couple weeks later, he called and he said, you got Clooney. And we're like, what do you mean we got Clooney? He said, I was having lunch, dinner with Clooney. He's in, okay? You got Clooney.
And I love this impression. Like,
oh. And so George Clooney was not able eventually to be part of it because he got busy directing a film. But then he called later and he said, now you got Cheadle. You got Don Cheadle. We're like, oh, that's great, you know? And then he helped us really line up a lot of people. So through Jerry, and then eventually we had a meeting with James Cameron. And he had actually been wanting to do something similar, a kind of investigative series on climate change. But he was tied up with Avatar and other projects. And he just said, I don't have the time to do this, but I will executive produce it if you guys really, you know, really run with it. So suddenly, all of a sudden, we had Jerry Weintraub and James Cameron as executive producers. And it was amazing, you know.
That's
and then
so
that,
amazing.
That,
what a story.
That allowed us to raise money and get other people involved. And then Arnold came on board as well as an EP. And then we just had to raise a ton of money and find a broadcaster and get the thing on TV.
So often someone will ask me, what does a producer do? And I think what you just described is the perfect answer to that. You know, as a producer, you had that initial idea and then sometimes it feels like through sheer force of will and charm and connections, you raise the money and then you bring this project to light. What would you say has been the most challenging thing of part of bringing high profile celebrities on the road, working with them to obviously use their celebrity to draw attention to this very important subject?
The hardest part is their schedules, because, you know, getting interest from big name people is not the hardest thing in the world. You reach out to their teams and they say either yes or no. It's another thing to get on their calendars. And it's just these guys are so busy doing things that you can't even imagine. I mean, they're just in such demand across the board from any number of either TV shows or films they're doing, or appearances for those TV shows or films, or, you know, they're involved in all sorts of different causes and they've got interviews, they've got, you know, charities and then they've got their own personal lives. And no matter how committed they are to what we're doing, it's just, it's super hard to get everything sunk up. I mean, you know, we had to fly Arnold Schwarzenegger to Kuwait to, an army base in the middle of Kuwait, which, you know, it's a long flight, and then you have to travel them to the base, and then you have to and then you have to kind of like deal with the time lag or time change, and then they're shooting, and then you have to get them home. So there's no way to go to Kuwait in under 5 or 6 days, right? And have any, I mean, that's the shortest you can do it in to get any filming done and have the whole turnaround. So you're asking 5 days from Arnold Schwarzenegger for one scene or a couple scenes, you know, and then there's other filming to do. There was, you know, we filmed with them in other places too. And, you know, getting Gisele Bündchen down to the Amazon, to the middle of the Amazon, is really hard. You know, it takes a long time to get there too. And she's got a security team, and she's got, you know, her sister, her two sisters came, one of them, they both work for her. She's got a big detail, you know, and then you have to move all these people through the Amazon. It's, you know, we had like a 25 person team that we had to move through the Amazon. Wow. For a documentary, that's a pretty big team. So there's like the logistics, there's just the scheduling, and, you know, oftentimes as much as they are totally committed to this, if they get a movie offer, you know, oftentimes they have to say, I got to take this part. This is an incredible movie. We had some people lined up to be in our cast, and then they got these incredible parts for like leading roles in big Hollywood movies. Mm. And they had to back out, you know, and it's like, okay, I get it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And, you know, to kind of compare season one into season two, I kind of looked back and I think season one was interesting. It was your first time out and you stayed a little more domestic, I feel, in a lot of those episodes. And season two, you were just like balls to the wall. Let's go around the world. How difficult was it kind of transitioning, you know, obviously, of course, with the logistic of the talent schedules, but as a production, as an EP, as yourself with your team to really like take it worldwide?
It's tough. I mean, you know, we knew that in working with National Geographic that we would want to do more international stories because they have a worldwide audience, you know, where I think we're being broadcast in 171 countries. And they really wanted us to have at least one of the two stories in each episode be overseas so we could have a domestic component and an international component. And we thought that was great because this is climate change after all. It's not just affecting us, it's affecting everyone. As I was saying earlier, it's a big logistical challenge to fly these megastars all over the world because you cannot go anywhere with Arnold Schwarzenegger, anywhere on the planet, without having a mob form wherever you go. I mean, we were trying to check him into a hotel in the middle of Idaho, in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was just like, and our PA who had worked with Arnold or people like Arnold before said, he warned us because I had no idea this was coming. He said, we are going to have to move him from the car to this little boat that was going to take him across a lake to his hotel. We're going to have to move him there as quickly as possible. And we cannot have him walk the 100 yards across this one field. We have to get him to be at least 50 or 25 yards away from the boat. Because if he has to walk 100 yards through this park, he'll never make it. He'll get mobbed. It's like, Tom, you're crazy. There's no way that's going to happen. So, but we did manage to get a place for his car to park about 25 feet away or yards away from the boat. And even in this like tiny little walk, he got mobbed. I mean, people popped out of nowhere. He stepped out of the car. Arnold stepped out of his car, you know, with his big cowboy boots on, and, you know, and he's just like stretches. And suddenly there's like these Russian guys come swarming in yelling, Arnold, Arnold, Arnold. And I was like, where did these guys come from? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, on the plus side, you have this person who has such a big following around the world and you get eyeballs. On the downside, it's hard to do productions because you literally can't move sometimes because they're just that popular. Same thing happened with Gisele in Brazil. She's one of the most famous people in Brazil, you know, of all of Brazil's history. And we were in the middle of the Amazon, but still people found out about us. And, you know, we had to bring on additional security just to kind of move her quickly enough so she wouldn't get swarmed by fans.
So you've got some of the most high profile celebrities in the world on your show, which will hopefully translate into eyeballs watching your show. What are you hoping the next result is? You know, I guess, what is the intent of your show? Do you produce it to inform, but then also to inspire action from viewers? You know, what are you hoping that the show succeeds in doing?
That's a great question. We get asked that a lot. We are not trying to take climate deniers and move them into understanding that climate change is real. That's just never going to happen. So, but what we are trying to do is elevate the importance of the issue. So someone who basically on a scale of 1 to 10 thinks about climate change at a 3 or maybe a 2 or 1, like barely thinks about it, we're hoping to move that 3 up to a 5 or 6 so that it's something that they start to actually engage in and act on some of the time. you know, they don't have to act on it all the time. We're not asking people to drop everything and suddenly just, you know, become a climate activist. But, you know, again, this election, we didn't, there were very few things talked about at the debates issues, but climate was not brought up again. I mean, it wasn't brought up in the first or the last presidential election. And we were hoping it would come up this time. And I think it would have, because Hillary kept talking about it. But you know, it was such a contentious election that they didn't really talk about any issues substantively. But the goal is to get this to be an issue that Americans really think about, because it is going to have a bigger impact than anything you can imagine. It's going to overwhelm all other issues out there. And you'll see that in this season. There's some really heavy duty stuff that we have in the coming episodes. And so hopefully we can just get that out to people. That's the goal, is to simply inform as many people about what's happening. And we have an action campaign this year too, which is really focused on getting a price on carbon. And what that means is to put a price tag on carbon emissions, because right now it's free to put CO2 in the air, even though the Supreme Court several years ago ruled that CO2 is a pollutant. And a lot of places around the world are actually putting a price on carbon. So California has done it. Canada just announced nationwide that they're going to have a price on carbon starting, I think, next year. And then it's going to be the price will go up every year for several years until it really has a huge impact. China's doing it. A lot of Europe has a plan. So this is happening around the world, but people don't know about it. Like, I know when I mentioned it to you guys just now, you probably had no idea what I was talking about.
Right.
And I'll mention carbon pricing to a lot of people, and it's really horribly boring, and it just kind of sucks as a thing to say this is the solution, but it is the solution. Because if you make pollution expensive, you get less of it. It's as simple as that.
Right.
And if you make coal and oil and gas expensive to burn, you know, the energy companies are going to switch over to wind and solar. It's just super simple when you boil it down.
Let's break it down to just like a personal, individual thing. So the put a price on it, hashtag put a price on it. That is the kind of the action campaign that you guys are working on. Me right now,
yeah,
in my apartment.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Yeah. What do you do? Well, there's a lot of things you can do. And we actually are going to start putting out like a daily action on our site and through social media. We're going to say, here's the one thing you can do today.
Great.
And that'll be everything from things you've already heard of, like, you know, here are the new light bulbs, the new LED bulbs that are out there, to ride sharing, you know, instead of like, you know, and Lyft has this incredible ride sharing program, especially out in San Francisco, where, you know, everyone just shares a car because you just share a ride, and you therefore you have less cars on the street.
I Uber pooled last night. I did. I like Uber.
Oh, you did?
I do. I Uber pool and Lyft Line and Via and...
Okay, so Uber pool is the same thing. Yeah, there you go. So that's something you can do. Even just sharing the story of climate change, telling people to watch our show or to watch Leo's documentary is hugely important, because we know that the people who have watched our show absolutely love it. But still, the vast majority of Americans still haven't heard about it. You know, like, what do you, they haven't heard of our show. And it's just, there's so much out there right now that, to try to compete, even though we're on National Geographic, and even though Nat Geo has put a lot of resources into pushing out the show, it's still hard to compete with Game of Thrones and everything else. You know, it's just, there's just so much going on. I think, you know, TV is just more saturated than ever.
PTV.
Somewhat like the podcast world, you know, it's just kind of breaking through is a tough thing to do, even with these big celebs. But we did at least double our audience from the last season.
That's great.
And we have a much bigger presence on social media, and we're hoping to get a third season. But the point is to tell these stories, to share these stories, tell people what's going on, and then motivate them to take these actions. And like I said, on our website, very soon we're going to be pushing out the daily action. So those will be coming your way.
That's awesome.
Well, I think in light of the recent election, there are a lot of people who want to do something, and I feel like the issue of climate change and watching your show and the information it provides and the call to action that that I think is inherent in it will hopefully give a lot of the people who are marching now and angry now and fearful now something to focus on and to act upon.
You know, I'm glad you said that because there's a story that we're doing, I think in the seventh episode, on a group called CCL, and they're called the Citizens Climate Lobby. Hmm. They have 42,000 members all around the country, and what they do is their mission is to lobby members of Congress and try to get people who don't either aren't acting on climate or are just kind of dismissive of it to come around on it. And we do a story on it for the show, and we show like what CCL does. And they go and they try to get members of Congress to come around on the issue. And it's just great. So Bradley Whitford, who played Josh Lyman on the West Wing, mm-hmm. he's the celeb in that episode. But joining, you know, one of our editors and one of our producers have just joined CCL because they want to go out and they want to start lobbying members of Congress, whether it's in Washington or whether it's, you know, the senators in their various states that they live in, or congressmen they live in, the states they live in, that's what they're inspired to do. So that's another action people can take. They can join CCL and start to like directly lobby members of Congress to come around on this issue, because that's the big stumbling block. But, and I don't want to give away too much, there is movement in Congress, even among the Republican Party, to start moving on this issue. And it's really exciting. So the more pressure that can be applied there, the more actually something might happen. Even with, you know, Trump, who doesn't seem to care about climate change, who seems to deny it, even with Trump in office, it's possible that we could actually have some movement sometime pretty soon.
That must feel so rewarding to be, you know, a part of that, to be able to use your talents as a producer to influence change and to empower people. You know, it's not something that we can always get to do behind the scenes in television, and I completely admire that. And I hope that you feel really great about that.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, I mean, you know, we wanted to make sure that season two was a mix of the impacts that are coming our way, because the impacts are unbelievable. As I said before, you'll be stunned to see what's coming our way. At the same time, there are all these solutions. So We position season two as a race against time, which is to say that the impacts of climate change are intensifying every year, and they're more intense than what climate scientists thought even just 5, 10, 15 years ago. It just gets worse and worse and worse. On the other hand, the good news also is getting better, because there's just more people involved. There are new technologies. There's communities coming together. There are lawmakers who are addressing this. There are people like Elon Musk, who's like on a one-man campaign to save the world with, you know, batteries and all sorts of technologies and his Teslas. And so you see incredible movement in the right direction. And for us, it's just, let's just tell those stories, you know, let's shine a light on these incredible activities that people and communities and businesses and leaders are involved in to try to make progress on this issue. So I don't know. Yeah, it is very rewarding. We're just lucky to be doing what we're doing.
Well, can you tell our listeners where and when they can watch the second season of the show, and also where they can find you on social media?
Okay, so the show is on the National Geographic Channel. It's on Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central. This coming Wednesday is a big episode with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Gisele Bündchen. Okay. And that's episode 4. We have our website, which is www.yearsoflivingdangerously.com, a very nice short URL. But everything is there. There's also a ton of behind the scenes stuff. You can see how the show is put together. You can go to Nat Geo TV and you can find the show there as well. On social media, we are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everywhere, and we're easy to find. I encourage people to join us or follow us on those channels for sure, because we are very active on social, and we're very active with our celebs on social. I mean, Arnold has something like 17 million followers on Facebook alone, and Ian Somerhalder has the same, and wow. Gisele has a lot as well. I mean, we just all told it's, you know, at least 100 million people. So that is the where the power of celebrity is really important. And I'll just say one more thing about our cast, which is that they don't want to be seen as experts on this issue, nor do we want to position them as experts. What they are simply people who care about the issue, who happen to be really good on in front of the camera, and who are smart and inquisitive and want to know more of themselves. And so you're not gonna watch the show and kind of be talked down to. You're gonna watch the show and go on a ride. You know, you're gonna find out, you're gonna learn as Arnold learns, you're gonna learn as Cecily Strong learns. And I think we capture that on TV. And so you really go for a ride in watching these shows.
Definitely, definitely. It's such an incredible show. Please, everyone, watch Years of Living Dangerously on Nat Geo. Support my good friend Joel, but also learn and absorb and do what you can. Take action, because this is our home and it's our planet, and we want it to be here forever.
That's really well put. The fact of the matter is the planet is going to be fine, right? The planet can withstand anything that's thrown at it, but we're not going to be fine. It's about our own livelihood. It's about our kids. It's about our grandkids. And, you know, I really hope that Trump comes around on this issue to some degree, because we can't afford to have 4 years go by where there's no action. However, if there's no federal action, there certainly is a lot that can be done locally. There's so many good things happening on the state level and in towns and cities all across the country. And that's actually where the most movement, I think, is going to be. So, you know, just because we have a president in office who doesn't believe in climate change doesn't mean we can't act. And I really firmly believe that. I'm not just saying that.
Well said.
All right. Thank you for that bit of hope. I need that. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having you on Inside Pop.
Thanks, guys. Thank you so much. Joel. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Such a great interview. I want to thank Joel again for joining us.
He's the best.
Now it's time for The Big Sell. We all know it's the time where we take turns recommending something from the world of pop culture we want the other to check out. So last week, I recommended the new single from organic moonshine roots music singer Valerie June. Amita, what did you think about her new single, Astral Plane?
I listened to Astral Plane as part of my therapy after this dark week. Amita. And I thank you for that. I do. She was, I'd like to say, like a little revelation. Like we discussed it last week. She has this real interesting twang, but soul and folk kind of vibe. And I thought it was so different. I haven't heard something like this in a really long time. So I really enjoyed, really, really enjoyed kind of like a different sound. What I will say is that I don't know if I completely loved it. I don't know if it completely kind of connected to me musically. And, you know, for those who may notice, or may, I think I might have said this once before, you know, when it comes to music with Sean and I think Sean is more of gravitates towards lyrics initially, and I go towards melody and music initially, because it's my background as a musician and a singer, and I think that's what I kind of, you know, absorb first. So musically absorbing her was a little more difficult for me, and I think maybe that's just because I don't really absorb a lot of like folk and country often. I do enjoy it, but I don't have it normally in my life. So that being said, all I know is that she was still intriguing, and I want to listen to more to really get a better sense of her and her sound. I still will think that she's great. I like her. I like who she is in this space with her amazing, gorgeous face and dreads and style. So I would like to give this a rating of 3.
Cool. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it is hard to jump genres, right? Like it's like everything that you said, it's like, you know, you're saying like inherently it's good. It just may not be a genre you love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, for me, I think, you know, I haven't listened to a lot of bluegrass or country. I remember 15 years ago, Dolly Parton put out a bluegrass album, and I listened to it a lot. Little Sparrow, so good. And yeah, I think for me, when it comes to bluegrass and country and organic moonshine roots music, which is what she calls her music,
that's Valerie amazing. June. I love that.
You know, I think it's just, I don't search it out. It's rare for me, but when I find something I like it a lot. So that's so I'm kind of with you. I don't do a lot of country music. The only time I've ever watched the CMAs was last week to see Beyonce.
And the Dixie Chicks. I love it.
And the Dixie Chicks, but Beyonce. It. Yeah.
I actually think that I would love to see something live from her. I think that I would really know who, like, her if I saw her sing live. If I find, like, a video or something.
Well, she is touring next year, and I may need someone to come with me to see her show.
Maybe. Should Maybe. We go? How many shows do we need to go together?
I know, really. Or you're like, or if any listeners would like to go with Sean instead.
No. Okay. Well, if listen, if it's the night that I have to go to Hamilton with a listener, then yeah, somebody, right. you know, just take one for the team and go with Sean to see Valerie June. That makes sense.
Everyone wins.
Yes. Right.
Everyone wins. Okay, well, I, as always, am excited to hear what big sell you have for me this week.
Oh, Sean, this week, as we've already said many times throughout this podcast, has been a really rough one. And it was very hard for me to think of something to big sell. But I had seen a lot of promotion for this music video over the last few days. And the more I saw it and listened to it, I thought it was actually the best thing that I could big sell. It is a throwback to last week's episode where we talked about Alicia Keys' new album. She came out with the video to one of the next singles called Blended Family. I loved the song. I loved it as soon as I heard it and the message that's in it. But the video is, it's just, I don't want to use this word, you know, without the weight of it, but perfection in different ways. The song is inspired by her family's personal journey. You know, she had two kids with Swizz Beatz, but he had children with another woman. And the song was to her stepkids because she had to realize that she's not their mother, but she had to try to be their mother. And so it's about a little bit of that struggle. And she said it. She said, "It's inspired by my family's personal journey to cultivate deeper understanding, compassion, support, and love. Something to me that I hope we all together in this world remember right now." When I read that, that's how I knew that this had to be this week's big sell, because it is something that I'm looking for right now and I think that we need. The video shows, it's all in black and white, which I also think was a very brilliant decision. It shows just her family hanging out and other blended families, and ASAP Rocky is rapping in the middle of it and this incredible line calling, "Love could bring us closer than blood." And he's there with his sisters and his mother. And in a couple of the shots, Alicia Keys with her husband, her two beautiful young kids, her stepkids, and the mother of those stepkids, all sitting on a couch together, smiling, enjoying being a blended family. I loved it. I loved everything about it. It's such a driving force of, you know, unity and family. And it's, you know, coming up, you know, into Thanksgiving too. It's just something beautiful that I think everybody should enjoy.
That sounds great. I have also Alicia Keys performing in Times Square. I've missed that, so I want to check out that video as well. So I have Alicia Keys videos on my to-do list. So that, of course, will go to the top, Amita, because it's your big sell.
Yes,
so that's
please.
The next one I will check out. But that sounds amazing. I look forward to checking out that video. I really like that song a lot. It's one of those songs that when I first heard it, I said, wait, is that a cover? Like, there was something so wonderful and familiar in a good way about that tune. I was just like, wait, have I heard this song before?
Well, the beginning riff sounds like that song that I can't remember the singing of, but it's, "I'm not aware of too many things, I know what I want, if you know what I mean."
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
That's the beginning
of
it.
Yeah,
yeah. And I love that song. So I think that's what felt familiar to me as well. But, you know, the chorus is, you know, what you do for love. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. That's what it's about. That's what we need right now.
Edie Brickell. That's who I was trying to think of her name. Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians.
Yes. The other thing that I found out upon researching this video and finding a little bit more about it is that she also did a 23-minute short film for The Gospel, which is one of your favorite tracks and mine too. So that's on my Alicia Keys watch list. Bonus.
Is that going to be called Mocha Lemonade?
It could.
I'm going to call it an Arnold Palmer.
Cocoa Lemonade?
This is a callback to We a few months ago talked about Florence Welch's album length video, which reminded me a lot of Lemonade, called The Odyssey, and so I called it Strawberry Lemonade, and so now that's our callback. Okay.
I love it. Alright, well, that is it for this week. Make sure to stay in touch with us throughout the week at Pop Insiders on Twitter and Instagram.
And if you like what you've heard, we'd love it if you would take a quick moment to go onto iTunes and give us a rating and a review. I think it takes all of 20 seconds. And that helps us reach more people. So we'd really appreciate it if you could hook us up with the iTunes rating.
Yes, please. Sharing is caring, as I always say. And up next on Inside Pop, a much needed break. We are actually not going to do an episode next week. I think we've all been through a lot over the last week. And I, like most of you, are probably looking forward to Thanksgiving. It's time to be grateful for everything we have, to enjoy quality time with your family, and give thanks to those we hold dear. So we're taking off next week. We're going to be with our families, and we wish all of you love, hope, and a great feast for Thanksgiving.
We will continue to consume pop culture, though, throughout that time, and we'll definitely have lots of pop culture reporting for you. But the very next episode is going to be super special.
Yes.
As you've heard us mention, we had the amazing opportunity to interview Cheo Hadari Coker, the creator and showrunner of Marvel's Luke Cage. So our next episode of Inside Pop, which will be in 2 weeks, will feature that interview. Lots of amazing insights and behind the scenes information, and he talks about how he reacts to some of the criticism. People dare to criticize that show, Anita?
I don't know who these people are, but they need to stop.
But he talks very eloquently and openly about so many facets of producing that amazing series. So we'll have that for you in 2 weeks.
So that's it for us. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for deep breaths with us and getting us through this episode. We do this all for you guys. Have an amazing week and an amazing holiday.
See you soon.